you're wearing.
Eye-catching headscarves from a Somali teenager in Maine on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to start the program today by talking about something you're probably already talking about, alleged remarks from Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling. A gossip website and program called TMZ aired about 15 minutes of audio tape where Mr. Sterling scolds a female companion about online photos she posted. Namely, he takes issue with her for quote-unquote associating with black people. Ironically, the woman, who's identified as V. Stiviano, herself identifies as biracial, Mexican-American and African-American. So here's a clip of Mr. Sterling.
I love
Minority. Look at all this negativity coming from...
There's no negativity. I love everybody. I'm just saying, in your lousy Instagrams, you don't have to have yourself with walking with black people.
As most people probably know, the majority of players in the National Basketball Association are black, including Mr. Sterling's team, the Clippers, who expressed their disapproval of the alleged comments by wearing their warm-up jerseys inside out. But we'd like to find out more about what this means, not just for the players, but also the league and Mr. Sterling and other conversations that have been taking place lately around race. We're going to start with the sports world, and we have two distinguished columnists with us. William Roden, sports columnist with the New York Times, is with us. Mr. Roden, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you so much. How are you doing, Michelle?
Great. And Christine Brennan is also with us, sports columnist with USA Today. Christine, thank you so much for joining us once
Michelle,
again.
Michelle, my pleasure. Thank you.
And let me start by saying alleged comments once again, because it occurred to me in the spirit of fairness, and I'm thinking about Shirley Sherrod, for example, the Agriculture Department employee who was falsely portrayed as a racist by an ideologue who edited and then posted her remarks. I think it's important to say that this matter is still being investigated. But Bill Roden, you're the author of a number of books, most notably $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. And I'd like to ask you if Mr. Sterling has a reputation in matters of race.
Yeah. He's got a poor track record, which, you know, you mentioned Shirley Sherrod. And, you know, Sterling doesn't get the benefit of the doubt because of a couple things that have happened in the past. You know, he settled out of suit. You know, there was a lawsuit. He was accused of not renting to Mexican-Americans and African-Americans. Then there was an Elgin Baylor suit where, you know, his treatment of Elgin, even before the suit was eventually thrown out or dismissed. But just the treatment of Elgin was just so publicly humiliating.
He was a manager with the association. He was an executive in the
He was a GM. So the point is that he's got a track record that does not regarding African Americans that does not allow him to get the benefit of the doubt. But you're absolutely correct. We still have to couch this in language that, you know, we're still trying to authenticate the voice and those kinds of things.
Well, let me ask you, though, Mr. Roden, and Christine, I haven't forgotten about you, but Mr. Roden, let me start with you. Do you think Mr. Sterling's thoughts are unique to him, or are they things that one has heard in the league?
Well, that's a great question, and of course, you know, you can't speculate. I mean, he was just stupid enough to get caught. I mean, I look at this as him throwing a good old-fashioned racist hanging curveball. You know, racism has become so insidious now and so under the radar and so multifaceted that it's rare that somebody is dumb enough to just get caught. But no, I mean, you know, every time I walk into a press box, Michelle, and see no African-American reporters, or every time I walk into a newsroom and see no African-American editors or like no report, you know, people are saying the same things without necessarily saying it. We don't respect you. We don't respect black people. We're not going to hire you. Don't want you around. I hear, you know, partners in law firms complain of the same thing, that there's like one of them or maybe only a clerk. So, no, I think you ask a great question. And I think it's probably one of the questions to ask is, you know, we could jump all over Donald Sterling. You know, he's just an 81-year-old man who's old school kind of bigot. But there are a lot of people who are younger, who are a lot more slicker, realize that they're smart enough to not get caught.
Christine Brennan, you've been in a lot of these same press rooms. What's your take on this?
I agree with Bill on so much of this, and Bill and I don't always agree on every issue we talk about, but we do agree on this one, Bill, and it's great. And Michelle, great to talk with you, and all these years we've all worked together. You know, I could say actually the same thing about women. I wish there were so many more women. Mm-hmm. Diversity is so important, and press boxes can often we can see one or two women as well, Bill, as we know. So we all have a lot of work to do. But things are better than they were. But anyway, I think this you know, I'm reminded of Marge Schott. Of course, she was the owner of the Cincinnati Reds in the 90s, and she was eventually drummed out of the sport, but it took a long time. This is baseball, of course. She said racist things, used the N-word, was awful in her language. One of the worst things she said, Marge Schott, again, the owner of the Cincinnati Reds, was that she thought Hitler started off well. Things, you know, that Hitler was good at the beginning. I mean, it was just abhorrent. And yet it took, what, 5, 6, 7 years to get her out of the league because she was an owner. And they suspended her twice. And then finally others got the ownership issue resolved and got her out. But I think that's the thing that, of course, strikes me, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners, Michelle, is that this man is the owner of the team. Let's say it again right up front, or I didn't say it yet. The comments are reprehensible. They're unacceptable. They're disgusting. They have no place, hopefully, in our culture, much less in sports. This man should no longer be involved with an NBA team or any part of our society.
But let me ask you this, though, Christine. The fact is, Bill mentioned the gentleman's age. Okay. This isn't the first time he's owned this team. Do we believe that these are the first time these comments have been expressed? And if that's not the case, why did his views... Well, there are two questions here. Is this the first time we believe his views rose to the level of scrutiny by the people in his peer group who presumably have access to him more than we do? That's number one. And number two, are his views expressed privately of note?
Well, and of course, that's you've hit on the key thing here is that now we know. You know, how many times are people, owners, everybody talking about things? He is 80 years old. He just turned 80 2 days ago, actually, Sterling did. And we now know it because of the Internet, because of our world. We now have a window into this world, and I'm glad we do. I'm glad we found out. But how many times has he said these things in private? Well, probably hundreds of times, right? And how many times are people of any age, not just 80, we don't want to give them a pass just because of that, but I think we can I don't want to say we can understand. It's within our mindset to comprehend the fact that an 80-year-old man might say these things, as despicable and reprehensible as they are. It's really awful when a 30-year-old says those things. But anyway, yes, I think it's good that we know. But for years, for generations, owners have been saying these things, and many others as well. We weren't born yesterday, obviously.
Bill Redden, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about L.A. Clippers owner Donald Sterling's alleged comments on race that came to light over the weekend. And the reason I mention it is that the owners, Mr. Sterling's organization has released the NBA saying, we've heard the tape. We don't know if it's legitimate or it has been altered. We do know that the woman on the tape, who we believe released it to TMZ, is the defendant in a lawsuit brought by the Sterling family alleging that she embezzled more than $1.8 million, who told Mr. Sterling that she would get even. And Mr. Sterling is emphatic that what is reflected on that recording is not consistent with, nor does it reflect his views, beliefs, or feelings, and that they say it is the antithesis of who he is, what he believes, and how he has lived his life. And he says that he apologizes to anybody who might have been hurt by them. This is in a statement that was released by the organization. So Bill Roden, again, the question is, are comments expressed privately relevant to his ownership of this team? I mean, and do we believe that this is the first time he's expressed these kinds of comments to others? And why are they only now rising to the level?
Well, if these are in fact his comments, no, I don't think this is the first time he said it. And again, I think that so that's the first thing. And also in terms of the privacy thing, if you're a bigot, you're a bigot. If you say it privately, if you say it publicly, you know, if you're a bigot, You're a bigot. Now, you could argue certain legal things about what's private. I mean, should your spouse, whatever. But if you are a racist or a homophobe or whatever, and it comes out, that's who you are, and you've got to be held accountable for it. I think, though, as this story has been percolating, I think the issue now is this is a major, major, major thing for Adam Silver. I mean, this is his first major issue. As a commissioner, and so far, I mean, the president of the United States has said he's enraged. Michael Jordan, who's a great player and an owner, said he's enraged. LeBron James says he's enraged. Kobe Bryant says he's enraged. Doc Rivers has said he doesn't know what Sterling could tell him that would convince him to come back. So clearly, this spark has now turned into this enormous forest fire, and Adam Silver had better act very quickly and very strongly and very decisively. He cannot let this thing fester. But the second thing, Michelle, and I think that, you know, we talk about the players. Well, the players are under contract. I mean, you know, this is 1968 with Tommy Smith and you're going to raise a fist on the stand. These guys are under contract. But I think the larger burden falls on fans, on spectators, the consumers. They are the ones who have to decide whether they are continue to buy this product. You know, in Montgomery during the bus boycott, you know, riders said, you know what, we no longer are going to buy this product because you disrespect us. And I think that if enough fans feel traduced, you know, that they will stay away. And I think that's a stretch because, you know, people tend to be addicted to the spectacle. Hmm. But I you know what I'm saying? So anyway.
Let me ask Christine Brennan for a final thought here. We have about a minute and a half. Hmm. Christine, we're going to actually talk about, we're going to dig into what are the ethical issues here and for whom there are ethical challenges in a few minutes with an ethics expert, Jack Marshall. But I wanted to ask Christine for a final thought from you about what do you think should happen now? I think what noteworthy to a number of people is the fact that current players are speaking out about this, including former players. So some people find that to be a sea change. But what do you think should happen now, Christine
Well,
Brennan?
I think he should, that Adam Silver, of course, the new commissioner of the NBA, should make sure that Donald Sterling doesn't come to any more games. So suspend him. Tell him to stay away for this season and should, looking forward even, Michelle. I think a substantial fine. What is substantial for a multi-zillionaire? I don't know, but it should be a lot. And then then you work to get him out of the league. And as an owner, again, that's not the easiest thing to do. You don't just say goodbye. But there are ways, and they need to do that. And I agree.
And why do they need to do that, Christine?
Why do they? Because this is a man who should not be involved with the league. It's at many levels, it's awful. It's terrible for so many reasons, ethical reasons for our nation, where we are in the 21st century, but also as a visible owner. I mean, just as the public relations side, which is so unimportant in some ways, but the NBA has to make a huge statement now that this is unacceptable. And the only way you do that is make sure that this man somehow gets out of ownership of his team and maybe the family takes over because the family's already issued a
statement. All right, we need to leave it there for now. Christine Brennan is a sports columnist with USA Today, joining us from her home office in Washington, D.C. William Roden is author of $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete, a sports columnist with the New York Times, with us from the newsroom there. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Please stay with us. We hope you will. We'll continue this conversation with a noted business ethicist to talk about how players, the fans, and the league might respond. We hope you'll stay with us. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Alan Cumming is reprising his role as the MC in the new Roundabout Theater Company revival of Cabaret. It's his third time in the role. He won a Tony in the 1998 production. On the next Fresh Air, he'll tell us what it's like playing the MC as he approaches his 50th birthday. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We are continuing our conversation about the comments connected to Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling. Basketball fans, the public, even the president are speaking out about allegations of racism because Mr. Sterling is reportedly on tape demanding that a female friend stop bringing African Americans to Clippers games, including former basketball star and business mogul Magic Johnson, and posting pictures online with black people. Now, Mr. Sterling has been widely condemned and denounced by people connected to the game, but we wondered about the ethical responsibility of league officials, players, and even fans in an issue like this. So joining us now to talk about that is Jack Marshall. He is the president and founder of the ethics consulting and training firm Pro Ethics. Jack Marshall, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks, Michelle. Always great to be here.
So what are some of your initial thoughts about this?
Well, I describe this as an ethics train wreck, because what's happening is an ethics train wreck. My definition of that is that almost everyone who touches it ends up breaching some degree of ethical fairness or ethical thought.
Why?
And I'm already seeing it because it's more complicated than it looks. You heard some of this, I think, from Bill Roden's comment about how, you know, if you say something privately, you might as well say it publicly, and this is who you are. We have throughout our history had people that undoubtedly harbored racist thoughts or deep bigotry, but managed through their actions to do great good. In fact, as you know, Mr. Sterling is scheduled to be honored by the NAACP in Los Angeles in May.
I think they've rescinded that honor.
But
you wrote about a personal acquaintance of yours whom you knew harbored profoundly racist and anti-Semitic sentiments.
That's right.
And yet, when he died an untimely death, he had a large number of people from diverse backgrounds attending his funeral with whom they had very warm and cordial relations. And you found it kind of puzzling, but you also said that it's, you know, there are personal sentiments, but there are public actions.
He treated everybody fairly and with respect. And in fact, despite the fact that he was a bigot, we argued about this all the time, he was not rich. He gave money to the United Negro College Fund every year.
So what do you learn from this? And what standard do you think should be used to evaluate Mr. Sterling's comments if they are found to be truthful, if these comments are in fact found to have been made by him?
The way I described it is it's like in law when you keep a vicious animal or a dangerous animal on the property. As long as you keep it safe and keep it from hurting people, you're fine. But if it hurts anybody, there's strict liability. And I think racist thoughts and bigoted thoughts are like that. Once they get out, however they get out, you're completely liable for the damage they cause. And there's no question that what he said causes damage to his team, to the league, to the business, to the culture. And therefore, he is strictly accountable for that, even though I have a lot of problems with the manner in which it was revealed. I mean, it's illegal, among other things,
sure,
in California to do this kind of thing.
I understand that. So that issue, I think, will be addressed
separately.
It's
a separate issue.
So let's talk about the other issue. Who here now is accountable for doing what, in your view?
I mean, I think he is 100% accountable for making statements, however they come out, that express his beliefs, that undermine the trust of his employees, that undermine the image of the league, and that can undermine and cause serious cognitive dissonance with fans. So there's economic and cultural damage done as a result of this, and the league has to move in any way it can to solve that. And he can claim, one of his funniest statements was that he apologized for the statements attributed to him, which is an odd thing to say. But you know, once this happens, once those thoughts are out, once you've expressed them, then you are accountable for them. And it's one reason why it's incumbent upon all of us to try to become as, you know, unbiased and unbigoted as possible. But it's also, we must admit, everybody has their biases. So in ethics, we try to urge people to acknowledge them and get by them through their actions, like my friend who I talked about.
Do the fans have any responsibility here? People have been talking a lot about the players, saying that the players need to make a stand here. That's a very small group of people with specific kind of legal relationships with the team and with the league and Mr. Sterling. I'm just interested in, what about the rest of us?
I think we all have a duty to build a more ethical culture, and that means sending the right messages. It also means, however, because, and this is why I think we can easily step on ethical lines while talking about it, we have a right, we have freedom of thought in the United States. We allow people to have diversity of thought, and we judge people on their actions, not what's in their head. I don't want to be in a culture where there's thought control, where we punish people for thinking things. But once we're talking about actual words that become conduct because they've been publicized, then I think every fan has an obligation to be part of the effort to build a more ethical culture and to say, we don't want this kind of attitude in our society.
It's interesting because Bill Roden pointed out that back in 2009, Mr. Sterling paid more than $2 million to settle a housing discrimination suit by African-American and Latino tenants in buildings that he owned, saying that he took active steps to discourage these tenants of those ethnic backgrounds from inhabiting his buildings that he had. So there was a legal proceeding. It was concluded. should that be the end of it, as far as our understanding of this incident?
No, I think it's part of the record. I think what's interesting about it is I very much doubt that his players were unaware that this man was a racist. I think it probably, because of the Elgin Baylor situation, I think it was generally known. But there's a big difference from knowing that you're playing for a man who may harbor racist beliefs and it being exposed to everyone that you as an African-American are now working for someone who has contempt for you. Then you have to do something about it.
Do you have to?
I think you do for a matter of dignity and also to demonstrate that you do not want to actively perpetrate the situation that you object to. Now, in fact, they may have been doing that in their own way and paid well to do it, but now it's out in the open and now they are hypocrites, and now I think they have to take action.
As you said, it's complex. Jack Marshall is an ethics consultant. He advises businesses and individuals on ethics matters, and he was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Jack Marshall, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle, always.
We are going to switch gears now and go to a place where fighting over racial and ethnic differences is about more than hurt feelings and lost opportunities. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Africa this week on a week-long trip where he hopes to highlight advances in democratic and economic development and U.S. partnerships on the continent. South Sudan is not on his official itinerary, but that country has to be very much on his mind after hundreds of civilians were massacred there earlier this month. It seems to have been a fight between two internal factions of this very young country. We wanted to know more about what this was about and what this means for the country's future. So we've called Mading Ngor. He's a freelance journalist based in Juba, South Sudan. Mading, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us for additional perspective is James Copnell. He's the BBC's former Sudan correspondent and author of a forthcoming book about the region, A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts. James, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Mading, I'm going to start with you because you're there on the scene. What happened? How did this start?
There was a political debate within the ruling party between the number two in the party and the chairman of the party. And then there was a wing that felt marginalized, a wing that was pressing for democratization of the party. And then in December, it became violent.
Right now, as you are speaking, what is the sense there?
Well, South Sudan's future has become bleaker, and the optimism that I felt 2 years ago is fading off. The reasons are quite obvious. In 2012, when I last spoke to you, our neighbor Khartoum was the number one existential threat to South Sudan. Now we have ourselves to blame for the mess that's going on presently. So it's a lot of bloody mess.
James, is there something you want to add about this? And just I want to mention that you were in Sudan and South Sudan when the countries first divided, or when South Sudan gained independence, as people say, in 2011. Do you want to add something to this about what do you think led to this most recent conflagration?
Well, yeah, I think Meddings is absolutely right that the tensions within the governing party were at the very heart of this. But it also, of course, comes from a longer process as well. The fact that before South Sudan became independent, it fought two very long, very bitter wars with Khartoum, with the capital of what was then the United Sudan. Millions of people died. Many more were displaced. There was huge problems of lack of development. And so when the South Sudanese leaders took on the mantle of governing an independent country, they had an incredibly difficult situation to deal with. But on top of that, they also themselves, in many cases, came as rebel leaders. And the party's own Luka Biong has talked about the liberation curse. That's the idea that the qualities you have as a revolutionary leader, as a rebel leader fighting for your freedom, as they in the South Sudanese people saw it, are not necessarily the right ones to build a democratic, consensual nation. So all the political energy of the new country was concentrated within the SPLM, the party that had taken the country to independence, but the institutions weren't strong enough and political ambitions were too big, and the people in power very often did a very bad job of governing the country, and that all led to the frustration and the growing political tension that eventually ended up with what is now a civil war.
And James, often it seems that political difference seems to track along with some other visible difference that people latch on to, right? Or you know, it kind of works both ways, like an ethnic difference then becomes kind of a vehicle to air political differences. And, you know, is there some kind of visible difference that allows these rivalries to fester or become easier to play off of, if you get my meaning?
You know? Yeah, well, look, South Sudan is a very diverse country. There are more than 60 ethnic groups. And all Southern Sudanese, or almost, voted for independence. 99% voted for independence in the referendum. But that masked a lack of unity among the people. So in the first year or two after separation, there were lots of inter-ethnic conflicts, often based around cattle raiding and revenge for those initial attacks that cost hundreds or even thousands of lives. And that showed a little bit the ethnic tensions. And so although this conflict at the beginning did come, as Madding said, from a political rivalry, politicians very often have ethnic power bases. Mm. And so this has become not an ethnic war, I don't think, but an ethnicized war in which ethnicity has played an increasingly large part, including in some of the massacres we've been hearing about over the last few weeks.
But I'm thinking about when we spoke to you back in 2012 about returning to South Sudan to celebrate its independence. I just want to play a short clip from our conversation then.
The day of independence was like a wedding night, but nobody was asking the critical questions. Like after a honeymoon, you know, came bitter moon. So the honeymoon was short. It took a few days, and then people realized that we are actually back where we were.
I mean, it sounds to me as though there were people who were concerned about this at the very beginning, concerned that kind of the foundations for civil governance were not laid at the beginning. Is that right?
That's correct. There's one unmistakable reality about our situation. History was always against us. What has happened has been a utter failure of governance. The majority of the populations haven't seen the fruits of independence. So at some point, there was going to be some kind of unrest. We didn't know what form it was going to take. So the present leadership and the elite have not charted a positive vision for the people. Now we see the fruits of parochialism tearing down the country. So indeed, there were always challenges, and the leadership did not tackle the challenges seriously.
So Madding, is anyone being held accountable for this massacre? Is there any sense of remorse? Is there any accountability being taken by anyone or anybody demanding accountability? And does anyone have the authority to do so at this moment?
Nobody can talk about accountability when war is going on. I have traveled around the country since the violence first hit in December, and what I have seen is disheartening. In Bor Hospital in late January, I saw an old man with a clutch lying face down, dead. I was horrified to also see an old woman shot outside her hut with her bloody supporting stick sitting next to her, and countless other abuses, you know. Then in an army base in Pibor, human flesh burned like chicken. In Malakal Hospital, where I was a week ago, I was disturbed to see someone print his name in human blood. You cannot talk about accountability in a situation that is still hot, and there's still tension, there's still fighting even as we speak.
James, can we have a final thought from you? Are there any efforts being taken internationally to try to bring some stability to this situation, eventually accountability, but at least in the near term, just some sustained peace?
Well, look, the region, the East African region, moved quite quickly to try and get negotiations going. And they have been taking place, but they haven't really achieved much. There was a ceasefire deal was signed, but hasn't been respected at all. And I think there's a growing international concern about the scale of the violence in South Sudan. So you've seen both the United States and the United Nations threatening sanctions. and we have to see whether those actually come into force and who they would target. But I would say that the first thing that absolutely has to be done is to find a way of stopping the fighting. And so what that would require is a much reinforced monitoring verification team, essentially military observers and, if possible, troops on the ground who could get in between the warring parties and, if not stop them fighting, at least observe who is responsible for atrocities or breaking the ceasefire, and then make sure there are consequences for that. Because until the fighting stops, until people stop dying in some of the really horrifying ways Madding was just talking about, there's no real prospect of getting to the serious negotiations that would eventually enable South Sudan to move forward to a more prosperous future.
That was former BBC Sudan correspondent James Copnell. He is author of the forthcoming book about the region. The full name of the book is A Poisonous Thorn in Our Hearts, Sudan and South Sudan's Bitter and Incomplete Divorce. He was with us from London. From Juba, freelance journalist Madding N'Gour, thank you both so much for joining us. We'll stay on top of this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, former Texas Governor Ann Richards was famous for her peppy comebacks, but she should be known for what she did to change the leadership of the Lone Star State.
She changed the way we think about who can and should be in office and serve in state government, and very proud of that fact.
We talk with her daughter, Cecile Richards, about the new HBO documentary, all about Ann, Governor Richards of the Lone Star State. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights at ajws.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Garrison Keillor, host of A Prairie Home Companion, flies into Central Illinois on Wednesday, May 7th at 11:30 a.m. to read from his new book, The Keillor Reader. WILL has a limited number of tickets available for this very special fundraiser at Frasca Field in Urbana. Copies of the book will be available for Garrison to sign, and lunch will be provided. For more information and to purchase a ticket, visit WILL.illinois.edu or call 800-898-1065.
Programs on WILL are made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
If you know someone, a friend, relative, or neighbor who's visually or print impaired and would benefit from having access to a completely free 24-hour audio stream of read aloud local, regional, and other publications, including newspapers, please contact Illinois Radio Readers Kathy Spiegel at 217-333-6503 or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we are going to tell you more about former Texas Governor Ann Richards. There's a new HBO documentary about her, and we're going to speak with her daughter. But first, something we like to focus on a lot on this program, which is efforts to open up tech careers and education to young people. Computer programming is one of the most sought-after skills in the job market, but you might be surprised to know that a majority of public schools don't offer any computer science classes. Today, we want to hear about a campaign to change that and bring coding instruction to students in middle school. Hadi Partovi is the founder of the nonprofit Code.org. That organization recently announced a new partnership program with public school districts around the country to provide computer science classes to more than 2 million students starting this fall. Hadi, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And for additional perspective, we've called Brenda Wilkerson. She's a program manager for Chicago Public Schools, which is one of the districts partnering with Code.org. Brenda, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us also.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Hadi, let me start with you. Why should this be a priority?
Well, you mentioned the shortage and the sort of the difficulty of hiring people into computer programming jobs. And that's certainly one reason. You know, the country has unfilled positions in computer programming in every single state and in every single industry. And the gap over 10 years is expected to reach 1 million jobs more than there are students graduating from our schools. But the reason I'm doing this is because I believe no matter what job you want to pursue in the 21st century, understanding how software and technology works and how to make it is something that every student needs to be prepared for their future careers.
Brenda, you've been working on this. You've been working on initiatives for the Chicago Public Schools. What do you think this partnership will allow you to do that you could not now do, that you haven't been able to do so far?
Well, this partnership will allow us to move much quicker and reach a much broader audience in our school district. We're excited. We've got 400,000 students, and I really believe that this effort, and we're very thankful to Code.org for their support, will allow us to reach those students much faster and on a much grander scale than we could have before.
Now, you're offering computer science now in 25 high schools. That's out of 187. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
So what will this allow you to do? I think it'll at least, let me ask it this way. What would you like to be able to do? Offer this in every high school, even below high school level?
Oh, that's absolutely the goal. Our goals are to saturate every high school within 3 years, to add a graduation requirement around computer science within 5 years, and also to introduce computer science as early as kindergarten in our elementary schools, 25% of them within 5 years. So we have very aggressive goals, and we're very excited to be able to reach them.
How do you tell me about that? Coding in kindergarten, is that realistic? Is that a good idea?
Well, it's totally realistic. There's lots of kids who can try apps that basically teach you the basics and the fundamental concepts even before they learn reading. You know, people's impressions of coding are set by things in the mass media where you see somebody in a basement typing away in a dark room. And the reality is that the model of coding these days is using drag and drop and a mouse. A 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old can get started.
So they're probably already doing it. Kids who have access to certain kinds of computers are in a way kind of already coding. Is that what you're telling me?
Absolutely. In families where the parents care about this stuff, there's kids already trying this out. But the vast majority don't know to do it.
Stick with me, though, on the resource question. I mean, because I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to this and saying, you know, our schools, you know, the teachers love them, but, you know, God love them. Everybody's doing the best that they can. But with the kinds of resource problems that a lot of local jurisdictions are having now, they're struggling just to provide, you know, the basics. How do you add something like this? Or how do you even begin to think about something like this as a matter of scale when people are already feeling like they're struggling just to do the basic reading, writing, and math?
So at the elementary or middle school level, I think learning computer science and writing computer programs actually helps emphasize learnings in math, because solving a math problem just on a piece of paper isn't nearly as fun as solving a math problem in the context of building a game or creating an animation, especially if you're young and you want to see the results of your work. At the high school level, you know, we're not requiring, Code.org isn't saying that every student should be required to learn this. We're excited that Chicago is doing that. But we think at the high school level, you know, students get to choose between biology and chemistry and physics. We don't drop those courses because we want to focus on reading and writing and math. We give kids the choice. And the fact that in 90% of schools they don't have a choice of studying computer science to me seems a problem.
Brenda, talk to me about what kind of reaction in the schools where their students already have access to computer science courses. How are students reacting to them?
Well, they're very excited, and that's the thing that makes this project even that much more important and timely. We've seen that students who get the opportunity to do programming find more relevance in all of their learning. There's a maturity that we have seen come across our students and a rapid development when they get to create and they get to understand what it means to be the innovator. We know that students learn how to use technology from a very early age. What we're trying to do is move them into a place where they can choose to be the innovators of technology. And doing so makes it just that much more exciting to be at school. And that's something everyone should be excited about.
So, Hadi, before we let you go, how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I've been in the tech industry for almost 20 years, and it's always been a mysterious challenge to me why there's not more people getting to the industry. And, you know, the idea came to me literally the day Steve Jobs died. I remember thinking, what's my footprint going to be in 15 years from now? He was about 15 years older than me. And this is what I settled on at that point.
What did you have, like, a eureka moment? I mean, was this one of those things that was data-driven, as so much of tech is? You kind of thought, wait a minute, why do we not have enough computer science graduates? Or was it just, did it just kind of come to you in a dream? I mean, tell me about that.
No, it was much more just sort of a gut feeling that, you know, I studied this. It helped make my career what it is. I've been very successful as an entrepreneur. And I realized that, you know, this is the land of opportunity. And the American dream is broken if kids don't even have access to the first course that gets you onto the path towards the most successful jobs in the country.
Oh, also, I guess, opens up a whole new universe of idea of innovators and, you know, employees for the industry that is to come. And it's almost like swimming, right, Brenda, that if you don't have access to a pool, how are you ever going to learn, right?
That's absolutely right. And the earlier students get access to it, the more likely they are to persist and understand their choices and gain confidence in their future.
Brenda Wilkerson is a program manager for Chicago Public Schools. She was kind enough to join us from member station WBEZ. Hadi Partovi is the founder of Code.org, and he was kind enough to join us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It's been 20 years since a Democrat was elected to a statewide office in Texas, and that year, 1994, also marks the year when the state's last Democratic governor was voted out. But what a character she was. Born during the Great Depression, she was a housewife, a teacher, a volunteer, and a political liberal who somehow managed to be elected to lead one of the country's most conservative states. All this with her trademark sense of humor, front and center. Here she is giving the keynote speech at the 1988 Democratic National Convention in Atlanta.
I'm delighted to be here with you this evening because after listening to George Bush all these years, I figured you needed to know what a real Texas accent sounds like.
Who could we be talking about but Ann Richards? Today, HBO premieres a documentary about Ann Richards. It's called All About Ann, Governor Richards of the Lone Star State. Joining us to tell us more is Cecile Richards. She is Ann Richards' daughter, and you might know her as president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and she's with us now from our studios in New York City. Cecile Richards, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Delighted to do this.
Did you think your mother was funny?
Oh, she was funny. I think it's actually sort of undeniable, but it's different when she's your mom, because I think sometimes it can almost verge on the embarrassing. But what you saw in public is what you saw in private. She's very, very much her own person and a lot of fun as a mom.
Was she fun as a mom? Because, I mean, she was a big personality. And sometimes, as you mentioned, for kids, that can be fun. It can also be kind of embarrassing.
I know. I actually think the time she came to pick me up when I flew home for college and she was dressed as Dolly Parton, that probably was the height of embarrassment. But no, I think in general, look, she was someone who loved life and she lived big. And I think as a kid, I now sort of recognize our family wasn't necessarily like other families, but it was pretty wonderful.
Your mom was ahead of her time in many ways. I mean, one of the things that you can't help but notice, it's one thing for her to have been the person she is right now, but she's the person she was when it was kind of difficult in a lot of the communities that she was living in and working in to have her point of view and to have take on the issues that she took on. Do you know where that came from? As we mentioned, I mean, she was a person who's an activist, you know, for women, for people of color, for LGBT individuals at a time when this was not easy to do. Do you know where that came from in her spirit?
Well, you know, it's funny. I grew up in Dallas, Texas, which was a very conservative city at the time. And sort of my folks, as mom described it, they were into politics like other couples were into bowling. Every movement that came through town, whether it was the farm workers, the labor movement, the women's movement, they were into. And so were all their friends. And I think it just became part of their life. And once she finished being a mom, or at least had raised all of us, she got to throw all of her energy into politics, but came from a point of view of really that politics was there to do social good and for social justice. And I think that is also something that set her apart sometimes from other politicians.
A lot of people who may not be familiar with her record in Texas will certainly remember her, if they follow politics at all, from the 1988 Democratic National Convention, where she gave the keynote speech. And as the documentary highlights, it was kind of a turning point in her career. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was already on the scene in Texas, but it was really that speech and that opportunity to, as she would say, sort of show what she could do to a national audience that really allowed her to make the race for governor and ultimately win that election.
Well, let's play a little bit of the speech from people who may not remember it. And here, this might be what some people might call the money bite.
George Bush hasn't displayed the slightest interest in anything we care about. And now that he's after a job that he can't get appointed to, he's like Columbus discovering America. He's found child care. He's found education. Poor George. He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
Now, I remember that speech and I certainly remember the campaign. And I remember that there were actually kind of mixed feelings about it. Because on the one hand, people in the hall loved it, but there were other people who thought it was kind of mean and in a way a little backfired. What do you think?
Yeah, well, she definitely skated on the edge. And I think, you know, humor can kind of go both ways. She, in general, I think, was very effective at using humor to disarm people. And again, as you said earlier, you know, she was trying to get elected in a state that was much more conservative than her politics were. I mean, it's a populist state, I think, in many ways. But she definitely had to engage people. And I think she did.
She did run for governor. And as we mentioned, she won. It was a brutal campaign. I think we can agree with that, right?
Absolutely.
The fact that she had struggled with alcoholism was something that she talked about during the campaign, not as if she had a choice. Talk to me about that, the campaign kind of from the inside out. How did she feel about it?
Well, it was a brutal campaign for sure. I mean, she was the first woman to run in that kind of race, and the gloves were off. Of course, the film, the HBO film, the documentary really captures that. It, I think, does a very good job of demonstrating what it was like to run as a woman, and certainly as a divorced woman, as a woman who was a recovering alcoholic, someone who had been very public about her addiction. But boy, it opened her up for a lot of public scrutiny. And it was a tough race, but she was never one to shy away from a fight. And I think that's also why people remember her. She was, as she would say, you know, you kind of had to take her warts and all. And people in Texas, at least for a while, they did. And she was very popular as governor.
She was popular, but couldn't get reelected. And I wonder, right, at looking back on it, did she see her tenure as a success or not?
She definitely changed the face of public officials and of state government in Texas. And for her, that was very important. You know, she appointed more women, more minorities, more openly gay and lesbian people than ever before. In fact, I think more than all the previous governors combined. And a lot of the folks that she appointed to office or who worked in her administration are now leaders in their own right, both in Texas and around the country. I think, to me, that's a huge mark of making something happen in four of what seem to be very short years.
What would you like people to draw from this documentary?
Well, I think one, obviously it's exciting that women and men would learn about mom, a lot of young people who probably never knew her. And I think she shows in this one that you can be amazingly resilient in this life, even when you hit some bumps, which she absolutely did. And probably what she would want people to understand from this is that public service is a noble thing. It's a good thing. And that you can, whether you're in public office or you're doing other things for social justice, you can have a really good life and help people along the way.
Some people might feel opposite, though. I mean, there's always this debate about why it is that more women, particularly younger women, don't get into public life. And some people say it's the nastiness of it. And having to, the fact that she struggled with alcohol, was a recovering, did, you know, master her addiction, but was a recovering alcoholic, is something that she had to discuss in the course of the campaign, and no getting around it. And if some people would look at that and think, I don't want that, what do you think she would say to that?
Well, I think she'd say, look, you know, you have one chance to really make a difference in your life. And it may not be for everyone, but it's a great chance. And you know, I think she was always concerned that too many women did sort of take themselves out of the equation, whether it was the public scrutiny or just simply that they never thought they had the right skills, the degree, or worried that their children were too little. Or, you know, there's a million reasons, I think, that women hold back. And she was just a big believer that you really had to go for it. And you had to go for every opportunity that you had as a woman. And I think that would be the message that she would give to young women today. And look, you can look at Congress now. It's amazing the difference that women in that, both in the Senate and the House, are making. And not only on behalf of women, but on behalf of a lot of, I think, social causes that we all believe in.
Cecile Richards is the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. She's also the daughter of former Texas Governor Ann Richards. HBO is premiering a documentary about Ann Richards today. It is called All About Ann, Governor Richards of the Lone Star State. You'll want to check your local listings for exact times. Cecile Richards, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, great to be with you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.